Gamini had already found time to see a revival of She Stoops to Conquer and a couple of musicals. So Gamini Bandara, though 9,000 kilometers away, was having fun. Ranjit sighed, spared a moment to be glad that his absent friend was doing so well, or at least spared a moment to tell himself that he was glad, crawled into his lonesome bed, and went to sleep. It took Ranjit long enough to get the code-cracking job done, 11 days, actually, with much of each day devoted to dredging up additional possible entries or inventing new ways for the computer to mix and match them. But then there was the morning when he came in, expecting little, and got the supreme delight of seeing his computer screen announcing, Dr. Dabare, password identified. What it turned out to be was the motto of the University of Colombo, Budi Sarvatra Brajate, wisdom shines forth everywhere, with his wife's birthday cut in half and interpolated between the words. Budde, 414, Sarvatra, 1984, Brajate. And the world of mathematical documents was open to him. Chapter 4. 40 days of data downpour. So in the remaining 6 weeks before the new school year began, Ranjit, for the first time in his life, found himself very nearly drowning in the cascades of the precise sort of information he most desired. To begin with, there were the journals of number theory. There were 2 major ones in the English language, and 1 or 2 apiece in French, German, and even Chinese, but he decided early on not to bother with anything he would need to get translated. And the books, so many books, and all now available to him through the interlibrary loan. Ones that looked interesting, though perhaps not directly relevant to his quest, were those such as Charlot and Opolka's From Fermat to Minkowski, and Weyl's Basic Number Theory, which according to the reviews was not all that basic, indeed quite advanced, even for Ranjit. Less promising, because apparently written for an audience not as informed as Ranjit himself, were Simon Singh's Fermat's Enigma, and Yves Elguarche's Invitation to the Mathematics of Fermat-Wiles, and the book by Cornell, Silverman, and Stevens called Modular Forms and Fermat's Last Theorem. Well, the list was long, and that was only the books. What about the papers, the hundreds, maybe even the thousands of papers that had been written on this most famous of mathematical conundrums and published, well, everywhere, in England's Nature and the American Science, in mathematical journals refereed and respected and circulated around the world, and in mathematical journals issued in obscure universities in places such as Nepal and Chile and the Duchy of Luxembourg, and perhaps hardly respected at all. Somewhat saddeningly, he kept finding little curiosities that he would have liked to share with his father. There was, it seemed, a strong tradition of elements of number theory in Hindu literature as far back as the 7th century AD and even earlier. Brahmagupta, Varahamihira, Pingala, and in the Lilavati of all places, Bhaskara. As well as that seminal Arab figure, Abu Ifas Omar bin Ibrahim Khayyam, best known to those who had ever heard of him at all, a number which had not previously included Ranjit Subramanian, as Omar Khayyam, the author of the long collection of poetic quatrains called the Rubaiyat. None of this was particularly helpful in Ranjit's dogged pursuit of Fermat. Even Brahmagupta's famous theorem meant nothing to him, since he did not particularly care that in a certain kind of quadrilateral, a certain kind of perpendicular would always bisect its opposite side. However, when Ranjit came across the 4th or 5th mention of Pascal's triangle and the taking of roots in connection with Khayyam, he sat down and composed an email to his father telling of his discoveries, and then he sat for some time with his finger poised over the send button before he sighed and pushed cancel instead. If Ganesh Subramanian wanted to have a social relation with his son, It was his duty, not his son's, to make the first move. 4 weeks later, Ranjit had read, or read part of, every one of the 17 books and nearly 180 papers in his bibliography. It hadn't been rewarding. He had hoped for some stray insight that would clarify everything else. That didn't come. He found himself led up a dozen different blind alleys, over and over, because many of the mathematician authors were following the same paper trails as himself. 5 or 6 times each, he was re-examining Wieferich's relatively prime exponents and Sophie Germain's work on certain odd primes and Kummer's theory of ideals and, of course, Euler and, of course, every other mathematician who had innocently ambled into Fermat's lethally inviting tar pit and bellowing in fear and pain like any other trapped dire wolf, mastodon, or saber-toothed cat had never escaped. The plan was not working. With less than a week before the new school year began, Ranjit faced the fact that he was trying to work too many angles at once. It was something like the very GSSM syndrome Gamini had warned him against. So he determined to simplify his attack. Being Ranjit Subramanian, his idea of simplifying was to make a head-on attack on that hated and endlessly long wiles-proof, the one that only a handful of the world's leading mathematicians dared claim they understood. He gritted his teeth and began. The first steps were easy, but then he worked further into Weyl's ugly chain of reasoning, and it began to get, well, not hard exactly, not for the likes of Ranjit Subramanian, but at least it began to require concentrated attention for every line. Because that was when Wiles began considering the equations for curves in the XY plane, and for elliptical curves, and for the many solutions to the equation for modularity, which was when Wiles, for the first time ever, was able to demonstrate that what was called the Taniyama-Shimura-Weil conjecture, namely that any infinite class of elliptical curves was modular, was valid. And then, while Gerhard Frey and Kenneth Ribet had demonstrated that a certain elliptical curve could not be modular, Wiles himself was able to demonstrate that that same curve necessarily had to be modular. And, aha, there it was, a veritable contradiction. A contradiction was the mathematical pot of gold that sometimes lay at the end of some interminable mathematical trail. A contradiction was the thing that mathematicians gladly devoted their lives to finding, because if logical deductions from your starting equation wind up with two conclusions that contradict each other, then your starting equation itself must be wrong. And so it was proved, sort of proved, that Fermat had spoken truth. The square was the limit. The sum of no two cubes would ever be another cube, and so on for every other exponent this side of infinity. But Ranjit was no nearer to finding his own less daunting proof of what Fermat had so casually mentioned so long ago. And, oh yes, he was not aware that his picture was being taken. The beings that were doing the picture-taking were another of those client races of the Grand Galactics. These were called the Machine-Stored, and of course Ranjit never saw them. They didn't intend to be seen. They generally weren't ever seen, either, although under certain rare combinations of starlight, moonlight, and gegenschein, a few of them had occasionally been detected by an occasional human being. When reported, these sightings were generally referred to as sightings of flying saucers, thus adding to the vast catalogue of fakes, mistakes, and downright lies that made it nearly certain no respectable scientist would ever pay any attention to them. What the machine stored were doing on Earth at that time was anticipating a need of the Grand Galactics, whose needs and wishes the machine stored always catered to. The Grand Galactics hadn't ordered this activity, but the machine stored were permitted to use their own discretion in certain limited circumstances. The special quality of the machine stored lay in the fact that they had trashed their planet even more diligently than the 1.5s, to the point where organic life on its surface was now completely impossible. The 1.5s had dealt with the problem by adding infinite prostheses to their vulnerable organic bodies. The machine stored took a different tack. They abandoned their physical planet, and indeed abandoned everything physical at all. They reconstituted themselves as something like computer programs, and allowed their now quite frail and sickly bodies the privilege of death, while the individuals lived on in cyberspace, since which their despoiled planet had begun to show the beginning signs of regeneration. Not all of its liquid water was now toxic, for instance, though it still would have been pretty much a hellhole for anything organic. And the machine stored themselves? Why, they made themselves useful. Sometimes when the Grand Galactics chose to move a certain quantity of objects or beings from one star system to another, the machine stored were instructed to do the moving. And when they had detected those first microwave and then nuclear pulses from Earth, they'd known the Grand Galactics would take an interest. They didn't wait for orders. They at once began to survey the planet and everything on it, and to pass those findings at once to the corner of the galaxy where the Grand Galactics swam in their dark energy streams. Of course, the machine stored had no good idea of just what the human race was up to in its various activities. For that, they would have needed to understand human languages. That didn't happen. The Grand Galactics preferred that their client races be ignorant of any languages but their own, because if the races could freely talk to one another, who knew what they might be saying? Ranjit would have been astonished to know that his own picture had been flashed across interstellar space in that manner. It had, though. So had the pictures of everyone and almost everything on Earth, because the machine stored, if not omnipotent, were diligent. And hoped that the Grand Galactics would appreciate, or at least tolerate, that diligence. When Ranjit's bedside radio woke him for the first day of his new term, he leaped out of bed in order to turn it off. His first class, Astronomy 101, The Geography of the Solar System, was also pretty close to his last hope that the university would provide him with anything interesting over the next 3 years. That was mildly cheering in itself. And then, as he was leaving the building, the porter handed him a letter, from London, and therefore from Gamini, and Ranjit actually did feel a little bit cheerful. Hunched over his breakfast, he read the letter. It didn't take very much time. The letter was even shorter than its predecessor, and almost entirely devoted to describing Gamini's superb maisonette. "You enter from the street and go up a flight of stairs. Then you're in the living room. The Brits call it the reception. Next to that room is a doll-sized kitchen, and that's all there is on that floor. There's a separate flight of stairs going down from the reception to the back, where there's a spare room that looks out on a few square meters of mud that might be supposed to be a garden. I guess I'll call that the guest room, but I don't plan to be putting up any overnight guests in it, unless, my man, you want to drop by for a weekend sometime. Going back to the reception floor, there's another flight of stairs that takes you up to the bedroom and bath. Not very convenient for anybody sleeping in the guest room if he needs to have a pee in the middle of the night. And let's go back to the kitchen. It's got everything you'd want in a modern kitchen, but in dollhouse sizes. Tiny fridge, tiny stove, tiny sink, and the tiniest washer-dryer you've ever seen. I said it was about big enough to handle a pair of socks, but Madge said it could only if you did just one sock at a time. Anyway, such as it is, it's mine, even if all the furnishing is early cheap. Only now I've got to run, because a bunch of us are going to see the new Stoppard revival, and we want to have dinner first. Ranjit managed a smile at the thought of Gamini doing laundry, the Gamini for whom laundry had always been what you took home and gave to the servants, who the next morning would return it to you cleaned ironed, and folded. That did not keep him from wondering just who this Madge was. So he showed up for his first class prepared for disappointment. But then, wonderfully, miraculously, that was not at all what happened. Chapter 5. From Mercury to the Oort. The place where Astronomy 101 was given wasn't a regular classroom. It was one of the rooms that were designed like miniature theaters, with curved rows of seats enough for 100 students. Almost every seat was occupied, too, right down to the level that held a desk, a chair, and a lecturer who didn't look to be much older than Ranjit himself. His name was Joris Voorhoost. He was obviously a burgher, and it was almost as obvious that he had chosen to leave the island for his graduate schooling. The schools he had gone to impressed Ranjit, too. They were hallowed names for astronomers. Dr. Voorhoost had got his master's at the University of Hawaii at Hilo, where he had interned on the vast old Keck telescopes, and he'd gone on to his doctorate at Caltech with a side order of working at the Jet Propulsion Laboratory in Pasadena. At JPL, he had been part of the team that ran Far Away, the spacecraft that had flown by Pluto into the Kuiper Belt, or into the rest of the Kuiper Belt, as Voorhoost would say, because he was loyal to the old profession-wide decision that had stripped Pluto of its claim to true planethood, so that now it was just one more of the countless millions of Kuiper snowballs. Actually, Voorhoost told the class, Far Away had gone pretty much all the way through the Kuiper Belt by now, and was already taking aim at the nearer fringes of the Oort cloud. Voorhoost went on to explain what all those unfamiliar, at least to Ranjit, things were, and the boy was fascinated. And then, when the class was nearly over, Voorhoost gave them some good news. Everyone in the class, he announced, would have the privilege of looking through Sri Lanka's best telescope at the observatory on the slopes of Pidiruthalagala. A really neat 2-meter reflector, he said. And then he added, it was a present from the government of Japan, replacing a smaller one they'd given us earlier. That got a smattering of applause from the students, but that was nothing compared to what they did when he said, oh, and by the way, my computer password is Far Away. You're all welcome to use it to access any astronomical material on the web. Then there were actual cheers, among the loudest the ones that came from the Sinhalese boy in the seat next to Ranjit. And when the professor looked at the timer on the wall and said the remaining 10 minutes could be used for questions, Ranjit was one of the first to have a hand up. Yes? Voorhoost said, looking at the identifying board on his desk. Ranjit? Ranjit stood up. I'm just wondering if you've ever heard of Percy Molesworth. Molesworth, eh? Voorhoost shaded his eyes to get a better look at Ranjit. Are you from Trincomalee? Ranjit nodded. Yes, he's buried there, isn't he? And yes, I have heard of him. Did you ever look up his crater on the moon? Go ahead. Far Away will give you access to the JPL page. That was precisely what Ranjit did the minute the class was over. He quickly located Jet Propulsion Laboratory on the World Wide Web on the rank of computers in the hall and downloaded a splendid image of the lunar crater named Molesworth. It was indeed impressive, nearly 200 kilometers across. Though an almost flat plain, its interior was dotted with a dozen genuine meteor-made craters, including one with a magnificent central peak. Ranjit thought of his visits to Molesworth's grave in Trincomalee with his father. How nice it would have been to let his father know that he had seen the lunar crater for himself. But to do that seemed impossible. The rest of Ranjit's courses, naturally, were nowhere near as interesting as Astronomy 101. He'd signed up for anthropology because he'd expected it would be easy for him to get through without actually thinking much about it. As it developed, it was easy, although the other salient fact about it, as Ranjit learned, was that it was very nearly terminally tedious. And he'd signed up for psychology because he'd wanted to hear more about this GSSM syndrome. But in the first session, the teacher informed him that he didn't believe in GSSM, no matter what some other professor in some other class might say. "Because if multitasking made you stupid, how would any of you ever manage to graduate?" Finally, he was taking philosophy because it looked like the kind of thing you could bluff your way through without the necessity of a lot of studying. There, he had been wrong. Professor De Silva was a devotee of the practice of giving spot quizzes almost every week. That would have been tolerable enough, perhaps, but Ranjit quickly also learned that the professor was the kind who required his classes to memorize dates. For a while, Ranjit tried to take an interest in the subject. Plato was not a total waste of time, he thought, nor Aristotle. But when Professor De Silva began getting up to the Middle Ages with Peter Abelard and Thomas Aquinas and all those people, things got worse. Ranjit did not really care about the difference between epistemology and metaphysics, or whether God existed, or what reality really was exactly, so his flicker of interest flickered a bit more, and then went out. But wonderfully, the joy of exploring Saul's other worlds kept getting better and better, especially when, in the second session, Dr. Vorholst got into the possibilities of actually visiting some of the planets, at least perhaps one or two of the least forbidding ones. Vorholst ran through the list for them. Mercury? No. You would hardly want to go there because it was far too hot and dry, even though there did appear to be some water, actually ice, at one pole. Venus looked to be even worse, wrapped in that carbon dioxide blanket that trapped heat. The same kind of blanket, Vorholst told the class, that is causing the global warming right here on Earth that I hope we may actually one day escape, or at least the worst parts of it. On Venus, he added, those worst parts had added up to a surface temperature that would melt lead. Next out was the Earth, which we don't actually need to colonize anymore, Vorholst joked, because apparently someone, or something, did already, a good long time ago. He didn't give them a chance to react to that, but went right on. So let's look at Mars. Do we want to visit Mars? More interesting, is there life there? That argument went back and forth for years. The American astronomer Percival Lowell, he said, had thought not only that there was life on Mars, but that it was a highly civilized, massively technological kind of life, capable of building the enormous network of canals Giovanni Schiaparelli had observed on its surface. Better telescopes, with the help of the late Captain Percy Molesworth of Trincomalee, ruined that idea when it was established that Schiaparelli's canali were only random markings that his eye had tricked him into linking into straight lines. Then the first three Mariner missions ended that debate by sending back pictures of a surface that was arid, cratered, and cold. But, Dr. Vorholst finished, better photographs of the surface of Mars since then have shown indications of actual flowing water. Not flowing any more now, of course, but pretty definitely real water that did flow sometime in the past. So the life on Mars people were riding high again. But, he added, then the pendulum swung back. So which way is right? Dr. Vorholst swept the audience with his glance, then grinned. I think the only way we'll know is to send some people there, preferably with a lot of digging equipment. He paused. Then he said, I guess your next question is, what would they be digging for? But before I answer that, do any of you know of a place in the solar system that we have left out so far? Silence for a moment, while 100 students counted on their fingers Mercury, Venus, Earth, Mars, until a young woman in the front row called, Are you talking about the moon, Dr. Vorholst? He glanced at his finder plate for her name, then tipped her a salute. Right on, Roshini. But before we get to the moon, let me show you some pictures of a place I've actually been to, namely Hawaii. He turned to the wall screen behind him, which had begun to display a nighttime shot of a dark hillside running down to the sea. The slope was dotted with splotches of red fires, like the campsite of an army, and where the splotches reached the shoreline, there were violent pyrotechnics with fiery meteors flying above the surface. That's Hawaii, Voorhoofd said. The Big Island. The volcano Kilauea is erupting, and what you see is its lava flowing into the sea. As it flows along, each little stream begins to cool on the outside, and so it forms a sort of a pipe of hardened stone that the liquid lava flows on through. Only sometimes the lava breaks through the pipe. Then you see these isolated patches of red-hot lava shining out. He gave the class time to wonder why they were looking at Hawaii when the subject had ostensibly been the moon. Then he touched his controller again. Now the screen displayed Dr. Voorhoofd himself along with a rather good-looking young woman in a skimpy sunsuit. They were standing at the entrance to what looked like an overgrown cave in the middle of a tropical rainforest. "That's Annie Škoda there with me," Voorhoofd told the class. "She was my thesis advisor in Hilo. And don't get any ideas, because about a month after that picture was taken, she married somebody else. What we're just about to go into there is what Americans call the Thurston Lava Tube. I prefer the Hawaiian name, which is Nahuku, because actually the man named Thurston that the other name comes from had nothing to do with the tube. He was just a newspaper publisher who campaigned for creating the volcano's national park. Anyway, what happened was that maybe 400 or 500 years ago, Kilauea, or possibly the earlier volcano, Mauna Loa, was in eruption. It poured out lava. The lava formed tubes. When the lava stopped flowing, the liquid stuff ran out of the tubes. But the tubes remained as great big pipes of rock. Over time, they got covered up with mud and dirt and God knows what, but they were still there. He paused, looking up at the rows of students. Anyone care to guess what this has to do with the moon? 20 hands went up at once. Voorhoofd picked the boy next to Ranjit. Yes, Jude? The boy stood up eagerly. There were volcanoes on the moon, too. The professor nodded. You bet there were. Not very recently, because the moon is so small it cooled off long ago. But we can still see where there were humongous ones, where the basaltic lava flows still cover hundreds of square kilometers, and there are plenty of domes on the moon, on the plains or actually inside a crater, that are probably volcanic in origin. And if there are flows and domes, there was lava, and if there was lava, there was what? Lava tubes, a dozen students said at once, Ranjit being one of them. Lava tubes, exactly, Voorhoofd agreed. On Earth, tubes like Nahuku rarely grow to more than a couple of meters in diameter, but the moon is a different matter. In the moon's trivial gravity, they could grow 10 times as big, could grow to the size of the channel between England and France. And they're sitting there, waiting for some human being to come along and dig down to one of them and caulk it, very thoroughly caulk it, and fill it with air, and then rent out bedroom space in it to immigrants from Earth. He looked up at the timing light over the screen, which had gone from green to amber and was now flashing red. And that's the end of today's session, he said. But, as a matter of fact, it really wasn't, because at least a dozen hands were still up. Dr. Voorhoofd cast a rueful glance at the implacably red timing light, but surrendered. All right, he said. One more question. What is it? Several of the hand-raisers dropped their own hands to turn eagerly toward a boy Ranjit had seen in the company of the boy who was his seatmate, Jude. He spoke right up, as though he had been waiting for his chance. Dr. Voorhoofd, he said. A few of us would like to know your opinion on something. What you say often sounds as though you think intelligent life might be quite common in the galaxy. Do you think that is true? Voorhoofd gave him a quizzical look. Come on, guys, how do I know some of you don't have brothers-in-law who work as newspaper reporters? And if I say what you want me to say, what's the story going to be? University Stargazer claims countless alien races will compete with humanity? The boy stood his ground. Do you? He asked. Voorhoofd sighed. All right, he said. It's a fair question, and I'll give you a fair answer. I know of no scientific reason why there could not be a number, perhaps a quite large number, of life-bearing planets in our galaxy, nor of any scientific reason why some number of them have not developed scientifically advanced civilizations. That's the truth. I have never denied it. Of course, he added, I'm not talking about your crazy super-beings out of the comics who want to make us humans their slaves, or maybe exterminate us entirely. Like, what were their names? Superman's enemies that his father had captured before their planet blew up and put into a floating space prison that looked sort of like a cubicle paperweight, only something happened and they all got loose. A voice from the back row was already shouting, You mean General Zod? And another voice came up with, And the girl, Erna. And then half a dozen others put in, And Non. The professor gave them all a grin. I'm happy to see that so many of you are so well-versed in the classics. Anyway, trust me on this. They don't exist. No hideous space aliens are going to decide to exterminate us, and now let's get out of here before they call the campus police. Although Dr. Joris Voorhoost had never heard of the Grand Galactics or any of their client species, and would have been likely to give a very different answer if he had, he technically was still quite right in what he said. No space aliens were going to decide to exterminate the human race. The only space aliens interested in the subject had already made the decision to do so, and had then gone on to more entertaining matters. The Grand Galactics were not motivated to keep their turf clear of inimical species out of any notion of living in peace and amity. What they desired and attained was an existence with the least possible distraction from their main interests. Some of these interests had to do with their plans for an ideal galactic environment, which they had some hope of attaining in another 10 or 20 billion years. Other interests were more like what humans might call the appreciation of beauty. The Grand Galactics found many things beautiful, including what humans would describe as numbering, nucleonics, cosmology, string and non-string theory, causality, and many other areas. In their enjoyment of the fundamental aspects of nature, they might spend centuries, millennia if they chose, contemplating the rich spectral changes as one by one some single atom lost its orbital electrons. Or they might study the distribution of prime numbers greater than 10 to the 50th power, or the slow maturation of a star from wispy gas and thin scattered particles through the initiation of nuclear burning to its terminal state as a cooling white dwarf, or again as a cloud of wisps and particles. Oh, they did have other concerns. One, for example, was their project of increasing the proportion of heavy elements relative to primordial hydrogen in the galaxy's chemical makeup. They had a valid reason for this program, but not one that contemporary human beings would have understood. Their other concerns were even less comprehensible to the likes of humanity. But, yes, they did consider the suppression of potentially dangerous civilizations worth doing. Therefore, the data concerning planet Earth required action. Their cease-and-desist order radioed to the human planet at Light's lazy stroll was still years from reaching its target. It would not be enough. Would not matter at all, in fact, because more urgent action was required. These upstart bipedal vertebrates not only possessed the technology of nuclear fission and fusion to an extent capable of creating inconveniencing weaponry, they already possessed a vast planet-wide weapons industry to build on. The situation was even more annoying than the Grand Galactics had supposed, and they did not tolerate annoyance well. They elected to terminate this particular annoyance. When the Grand Galactics wished to convey an instruction to one of their client races, they had several delivery systems available. There was, for example, simple radio, efficient but ponderously slow. No electromagnetic signal, light, radar, that kind of thing, could go any faster than Dr. Einstein's beloved C, which is to say an absolute maximum speed of some 300,000 kilometers a second. The Grand Galactics had devised some faster machines, sneaking through loopholes in relativity, but those were at most 4 or 5 times more speedy. The Grand Galactics themselves, however, or any detachable fragment of them, being what ineffably non-baryonic beings they were, suffered no such limitations. For reasons connected with the geometry of 10-dimensional space-time, their travel was composed of a number of laps, A to B, then B to C, then from C, perhaps a straight shot, to their destination. For each lap, however, transit time was always zero, whether across the diameter of a proton or from the galaxy's core to its farthest-flung spiral arm. So they took the inconvenient step of detaching a fragment of themselves to carry the instruction to the 1.5s, and so the 1.5s had their marching orders almost as soon as the Grand Galactics had decided to give them. And because the 1.5s had anticipated what the decision would be, they were already in full marching order by the time the orders came. The 1.5s saw no reason to delay. Their invasion armada was quite ready to launch. They launched it. To be sure, the 1.5s were wholly material and thus not exempted from the speed of light rule. Roughly a human generation would pass before the armada could reach its destination and exterminate the undesirable species. But it was on its way. Chapter 6. Meanwhile, back on Earth. Things were looking up for Ranjit Subramanian. Well, they were, that is, if you didn't count the fact that Gamini was still 9,000 kilometers away, and Ranjit's own father might almost as well have been. And things were hotting up again in Iraq, where muscular Christian thugs with assault rifles were guarding one end of a bridge that they didn't want crossed by Islamists. The bridge was guarded at the other side by equally husky and well-armed Islamists who didn't want Christians polluting their side of the river. There were many more such things going on, but those certainly weren't the things that were giving some provisional happiness to Ranjit. Such things did exist, though. He was not only enjoying Astronomy 101, he was doing very well in it. The worst of his quizzes received scores in the upper 80s, the goodwill of his teacher as measured in the compliments he gave Ranjit's questions and discussion, scoring perhaps even higher. Of course, Dr. Vorholtz found some way to compliment nearly everyone else in the class, too. It wasn't just that he was an indulgent or lazy teacher, Ranjit decided. More likely it was that no one would sign up for his class who wasn't fascinated by the idea of sometime, somehow, seeing human beings going off to visit some of those bizarre other worlds. When Ranjit got his third straight 100 on a quiz, it occurred to him for the first time that perhaps he might actually have the makings of the kind of student who would make his father proud. So as an experiment, he tried taking his other classes a bit more seriously. He checked his philosophy teacher's list of extra credit reading and picked a book that had at least an interesting title. But when he took Thomas Hobbes's great work, Leviathan, home, it quickly stopped being interesting. Was Hobbes saying that the human mind was like a machine? Ranjit wasn't sure, nor could he make sense of, say, the distinction between meritum congrui and meritum condigni. And while he was quite confident he knew what Hobbes was saying when he praised a Christian state as the highest form of government, that was not a notion that appealed to the doggedly agnostic son of the head priest of a Hindu temple. Nothing in Hobbes, for that matter, seemed very relevant to the life of anybody Ranjit knew. Glumly, he took the book back to the library and headed to his room, hoping for nothing but a peaceful hour's nap. He found two letters waiting for him. One was in a creamy textured envelope, embossed with the university's golden seal. Most likely, Ranjit thought, a notice from the student banking people to inform him that his father had sent along another quarter's dorm rent. But the other was from London, and thus from Gamini. Ranjit ripped it open at once. If he had hoped that hearing from Gamini would brighten this unsatisfactory day, he was disappointed once more. It didn't. The letter was short, and it did not at any point say that Gamini was missing him. What it principally talked about was attending a performance of one of Shakespeare's less amusing comedies at something called the Barbican. For some reason, Gamini said, the director had dressed the entire cast in featureless white, so that half the time neither he nor Madge had been able to tell who was speaking. It was, Ranjit realized as he reached for the letter on university stationery, the third, maybe the fourth time Gamini had mentioned this Madge person. He was contemplating the possible implications of this fact while extracting a letter on the same creamy paper as the envelope, and then Gamini's possible failing went right out of his mind. The stationery was engraved with the name of the Dean of Students, and the letter said, "Please present yourself at the office of the Dean at 2 p.m. on Tuesday next. It is alleged that during the school year just passed, you made unlawful use of the computer password of a faculty member. You are urged to bring with you any documents or other material that you consider relevant to this charge." And it was signed by the Dean of Students. According to her nameplate, the woman at the dean's reception desk was a Tamil, which was encouraging, but she was also as old as Ranjit's father. Her look was cold. "You are expected," she informed him. "You may go right into the dean's private office." Never before had Ranjit had occasion to visit the Dean of Students. He knew what the man looked like, though. The faculty file on the university's home page supplied photos, and the elderly man reading a newspaper at the huge mahogany desk definitely was not him. But he put down his paper and rose, not exactly with a smile, but certainly without the hanging judge look Ranjit had expected. "Come in, Mr. Subramanian," he called. "Sit down. I'm Dr. Denzel Davutboy, chairman of the mathematics department, and as mathematical matters seem to play a significant role here, the dean asked me to conduct this interview for him." That hadn't been a question, and Ranjit had no idea what response would have been appropriate. He simply went on gazing at the mathematician with an expression that he hoped conveyed attentive concern, but no admission of guilt. Dr. Davutboy didn't seem to mind. "First," he said, "there are a couple of formal questions I must put to you. Did you use Dr. Dabare's password to earn money you were not otherwise entitled to?"
"Certainly not, sir."
"Or to alter your math grades?" This time Ranjit was offended.
"No. I mean, no, sir. I wouldn't have done that."
Dr. Davutboy nodded as though he had expected both answers. "I think I can tell you that no evidence has been presented to suggest either charge." "Finally,"